Our concern in these group meetings is the study of the essence of religion and living the religious life. Now, in connection with the study of the essence of religion, there are certain important points about which we should be perfectly clear. One is right preparation. The other is right approach. We have considered these points in certain aspects in past meetings, but we can never over-consider them because they are so important. Take the case of the person in the world who wants to enter a university or follow a skilled profession. In order to get into a university to study a particular subject, there must be natural aptitude and there must be a certain strong urge from within. A natural urge and a natural aptitude are both necessary to start with. Also, that person must have already, usually, not always, but already undergone some sort of preliminary training at school in that subject or in subjects related to it. So that he has acquired some knowledge which has been handed over from the past. His mind, as we say, is prepared. It is conditioned along such and such lines in order to become a master of this particular subject. And the same idea applies with regard to some sort of skilled profession. You have your natural urge to become a doctor or a lawyer or a musician or whatever it is. You have a certain amount of aptitude for it, and therefore you undergo a training for it. But all this means a conditioning. It means that our socio-cultural heritage from the past hands over to us certain things. If one has genius, one introduces something new, something wonderful, but you will find that that which is called new and wonderful is definitely a modification of the past. But a modification so extraordinary or so attractive that we say that the man has genius. Now, where the study of the essence of religion is concerned, there must, of course, be the inward urge to start with. If it is simply a case of mental curiosity, intellectual curiosity, or if it is a case of escaping from frustrations in life, then one is very unlikely ever to enter anywhere near the heart of religion. But granted the urge from within, the genuine spontaneous urge, one can't help it, it just comes naturally to one, to be profoundly interested in the essence of religion. Granted that, then we are up against this problem where the heart of religion is concerned. There is no heritage from the past for our training. The essence of religion cannot be handed over. It cannot be acquired as so much knowledge. because all training, all accumulated knowledge is confined to that which is limited, particular, something which begins, proceeds, and ends, which is born and dies, which is mortal. And that is no use to us, where the immortal, the infinite, the transcendent is concerned. It's extremely difficult for any one of us really to appreciate that. Appreciate it and understand it and see it in its depths. We may see it superficially because we have got logical minds, as we say. Our brains are good enough to work in a straightforward, logical way and say, yes, that sounds correct. Having said that sounds correct, it remains purely as an external sound. Inwardly one hasn't seen it. Because if and when one inwardly really sees it, then the whole of life is completely transformed. And that transformation has no relationship to what went before. It is the new. It is creation in the profoundest and the greatest sense. So you see, where the essence of religion is concerned, the mind cannot be prepared along conventional orthodox lines for the understanding of the heart of religion, which really means, therefore, to be in communion with transcendence. Our minds have to be completely empty, free from the domination, the limitation imposed by every single idea, doctrine, philosophy, teaching, conviction, belief, experience, knowledge, everything. It is almost as if we have to make a journey into outer space, into the great solitude between the stars of heaven, without any machine to take us there. Without any wings of our own to fly there. One might say, but isn't this absolutely absurd and impossible? There's no use my trying to get to these airy-fairy heights. No use at all. If you think in terms of use, don't waste your time. But if the urge is there, if that real concern is there, if that inconceivable and inexpressible mystery of divine love within one is there, one is unable to stop oneself from making the flight. This is the marvel of it. So, this right preparation is a preparation of a nature which is utterly different from right preparation in any worldly field whatsoever. Philosophy, science, art, anything. This is why religion at its heart is in a world of its own, utterly different from the world that we know in every other respect. But whilst it is utterly different from, it is not unrelated. Because this is the meaning of transcendence. That it goes totally beyond the known. But all the known I have to use the ordinary word, is included in it. What happens, therefore? There is only one total reality. You and I are aware of that total reality only in a limited way. It is my consciousness, my awareness, which is the incapable thing, which is the inadequate thing. Now, I can't take this incapable, inadequate instrument of my consciousness and deal with it in any of the ordinary worldly ways in order to make it infinitely capable. That is not at all possible. Because this consciousness of mine is a separative agent. It always keeps me as a seeing subject, looking at an observed object. So there is always a separation. This is perfectly right and proper where finitude is concerned. But where transcendence, the infinite, the absolute is concerned, it is totally improper, is it not? See, so I cannot deal with my consciousness like that. This self-sense which separates me out, this selfness in me, which keeps me separate, is the thing that has to disappear. And then it is this being, this person, who undergoes a transformation, a transmutation, which defies description. In fact, defies description. But it happens. And it is all utterly simple. And I, the person, you, the person, transformed, do not know the nature of that transformation. That's the mystery of it. Ask a cat. What is a cat? The cat will say meow. It will stare at you and wonder what on earth you are chattering about. Similarly, the one who, inadequate, confused, finite, limited, becomes transformed, he cannot recognize that transformation. Because recognition, recognition, means knowing again. But we have never known it at all before. How can we recognize in that situation? So with regard to right preparation for the study of the essence of religion, we must just bear this in mind, that all that we know in connection with right preparation for anything that we do or pursue in this world just doesn't apply in that sphere. Therefore, there is the question of right approach to the whole problem. We approach anything in the world in terms of acquisition, of gain, achievement, attainment, of establishment, and so on and so on. There is nothing whatsoever that can be gained or achieved or attained where the infinite, the transcendent, is concerned. How can I, the finite, gain the infinite? Where do I put it? In my pocket? Totally impossible. Now, we have considered these points often enough before, and yet we have never really become completely at home with them. Because when one is completely at home with this sort of vision, then one's whole life is utterly transformed, is utterly different. One is naturally the true human, the perfect human, the perfected holy one, the natural saint, the natural, unerringly understanding person with perfect insight. It has all become natural. So the approach is one where one must be completely free of any expectation, hope, desire to gain, achieve, or anything at all. One makes the approach because, as I said earlier, one can't help it. It is the nature of the person inside us. I'm not going to say beast now, because we have gone well past the stage of the beast when we are like this. It's the nature of the person inside us. And let us recall the meaning of this word, person, the true meaning of the word. In one of the oldest of the Upanishads, it is put in two or three sentences. He in whom all evil-mindedness is completely burnt out is the person. The word, Sanskrit word, is Purusha. Pur is from Purva, meaning previously. The Ush, the root Ush, means to burn out. And the Upanishad says, he who burns out all sarvam papmanam, all evil-mindedness, is called the Purusha, the person. You see? He in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out is the person for whom the essence of religion is like an open book. It's a book which needs no reading, for you yourself have become the book. You yourself are the book of life. The life which is purely human, truly human, in the profoundest sense of the word, which makes it identical with the life which, in ordinary orthodox terms, throughout the religions of the world, we call the divine life. So now, right preparation, right approach are very real things. So what is the actual task then? One may ask, well then in that case, what is the way to transcendence? Consider carefully. Can there be a way to transcendence? If I say there is a way to transcendence, I am immediately putting transcendence out there. There's the goal, the objective. And the moment I've put it out there like that, I have denied its transcendence. It has become a limited, particular, knowable object. Is it? Not at all. In terms of transcendence, this very consciousness, this mind, this body, this activity which emanates from this living being is no longer there. This as this, as a recognizable entity, is completely annihilated. annihilated in terms of transformation into that which is quite unrecognizable, quite unseizable, quite unbindable by the person here. So, can there be a way then to the infinite? Obviously, there can't. Because the infinite is everywhere. There's no way to it. It is here. Right here. And there cannot be a way. Because all ways, all the possible ways, and the possibility is incalculable, in fact, all the possible ways are here simultaneously. The way is your own living being. That living being, unselfed, completely freed of all selfness, is the way. Now you see, you will find that when somehow that inner consciousness, that inner awareness of these things has become real, there is a realization, a making real. When that is the case, then there is no confusion, there is no conflict, there is no struggle, there is no longing to tread away towards a goal. Life is utterly transformed. That transformation will express itself in all kinds of ways. What we in worldly terms call the spiritual ideals like truth and goodness and beauty and love and wisdom and all the rest of it, all those will be just naturally there. As naturally there as a human face has a nose and eyes and ears and so on. That's so. Now consider, in the ordinary way, we live this life which is self-oriented. Everything is oriented to the self. Every effort we make, whether it be an idealistic one or an obviously self-centered one, every effort is in some way or other self-oriented. You will find that when you're not talking with anybody, you will always be thinking, that is to say, silently chattering in the brain, in terms of I. At least every other sentence which passes through the brain will contain the word I. And in relation to that word I, there will be a wanting, a possessing, an attempt to fulfill the pleasure drive, one's lusts, one's whims, one's appetites, one's ambitions, and all the rest of it. Now this is a fact of our existence, of which we are unblissfully unaware. You see, this is what is our normal state. The animal, the pure, good, simple animal, is wholly self-oriented. Every energy it puts forth is directed towards its own self, for its own survival and well-being, and for its species. Now this is perfectly right. The animal will live and die for that. And that is perfectly right. But with man, it is different. Man is a mixture. Animal in origin, where the organism is concerned, possessing the animal drives, instincts, and all the rest of it. And the self-orientedness, which is our animal heritage. Now man, trying to free himself from this selfishness, as he calls it, postulates a virtue called unselfishness, which he opposes to selfishness. But that is a state of conflict, not a state of resolution of the discords, which means real harmony. It's a state of conflict. Man will also die, just like the animal dies. But the question is, how shall I die? Shall I die resisting the urge and the movement and the direction that transcendence gives? Or shall I put myself in harmony with the movement of transcendence? And to put myself in harmony with the movement of transcendence does not mean to oppose, to resist, to be antagonistic to the direction which my animal origin impels me to. So you see, on the one hand, no repression. On the other hand, no indulgence. This way lies freedom. Not by overcoming evil, not by fighting the good fight. Neither repression nor indulgence, but that mindfulness which stays wide awake all the time, observing, observing, observing. The change, the transformation is not brought about by my desire, by my thought, by my engineering the situation. Because I, as I, the limited I, will always engineer in the wrong way. There is no option to that whatsoever, for the very simple reason that I am limited, particular, finite, mortal, not omniscient. Not infinitely capable. It is the one total reality. Transcendence itself, use a theistic word if you like, Almighty God Himself, who effects the transformation. I must be unresisting. You see? I must even be free of the passionate longing to give and to be taken by the Lord, so to say. If I have that passionate longing, it's going to be an obstruction to the Lord taking me. The Lord wants to pick me up in His way. And He knows how to pick me up properly. But if I go yapping and kittening around Him, you see, I will always slip out of His grasp and just make a fool of myself. Now this is a point which we do not appreciate. Why not? Because there is the passion to escape from the sorrow, the misery, the difficulty of this world. We want to escape from it. We want to avoid the pain and the trouble. If we are masochistically inclined, we will invite the pain and the trouble, go into it deliberately. If we are sadistically inclined, we will try and cast the burden of the pain and the trouble on other shoulders and so forth. So you see, one has to be extremely mindful, extremely wide awake and quiet. Do nothing about it. Let the Lord do the doing. Our doing, our whole doing, is what may be called the negative part of the story. Our The spiritual doing is to do nothing in the worldly sense. And there is no other sense that my mind, my senses can see and know. This is where I am limited by my constitution. So then, there is no way to transcendence, and yet all the religions of the world have laid down ways. And those ways are the ways which teach us, which show us how to become unselfed, how to be unresisting to the one total reality. That is what the ways have shown us. They have been couched, unfortunately, in rather deceptive language. Practice this, you will unite yourself with God. Follow this path, you will realize nirvana here and now. To make positive statements like that always causes trouble within one's own mind. We immediately get the idea, there is the goal, now I know. I am going to nirvana by treading this path. I shall be uniting myself with God by following this mystical discipline or whatever it is. These are all misconceptions. And we just remain bound within them. Of course, the person might become a good man in the world, a better man, a saint. But mere saintship is not the realization of transcendence. And the heart of religion, the essence of religion, is concerned with that transcendence. Again and again, bear in mind that where the realization of transcendence is concerned, there is only one step, the first step. The first step covers the entire field. There is no other step. This is an extraordinary mystery. Now look how language deceives. The moment I say there is only one step to take, naturally there arises the effect of the conditioning of our ordinary everyday experience to take a step. Make a movement in time and space to perform a particular act, go through some special procedure. That is taking a step. But what can I do? There are no words in our human languages to describe just that extraordinary thing that is done, which is put in the verbal form, take a step. Take the first step. But the first step is the only step, the last step, at the same time. Now it is very important somehow to realize this. Because if we realize, we can see into it truly, then we will see that the taking of the step is free of all time limitation. It is a timeless step. It has no beginning or ending. That one step is a perpetual stepping. It is timeless. And in its timelessness, it includes the entire range of time. All chronological time is included in this single psychological moment, which is never out of step with the chronological moment. Therefore, The taking of this step in the soul covers the entire span of our life. You see, don't let the intellect try to grasp this and make it into too logical and clear-cut a system. There has to be an essential core of logic which must not be affronted. That essential core of logic is what enables us to make, I'm going to say, not just ordinary sense, good sense, but super sense out of it. A super sense. And in that super sensing, there emerges in ourselves the sense of transcendence. The sense of transcendence. If that sense of transcendence once emerges, it takes charge. And everything happens outwardly apparently the same in form and structure, but inwardly in spirit, completely different. Our external life will be just the same. Get up in the morning and all the rest of it till the end of the day. But as we go through it, our going through it will have an utterly different quality. Within our own awareness, outwardly none. The other person is not likely to see it unless he is extraordinarily perceiving. Extraordinarily perceiving. There is a basis for these things too, in ordinary everyday living. A basis which one may call the righteous life or simple purity. Purity in every way, in thought and feeling, in speech and in action. The great religions of the world have laid down what constitutes purity. We interpret the words. I, being a confused person, incapable, inadequate, will necessarily and inevitably misinterpret. I cannot possibly interpret the spoken word or the written word in its true sense, in its utterly true sense. I'll get a little glimpse of sunshine, there'll be clouds and all that sort of thing in the way of my interpretation. But if that urge is there, then the clouds begin to vanish, and one sees what is meant by living the pure life. And when one really sees the meaning, there is no conflict within oneself in connection with living the pure life. You know the sort of conflict we go through. We all go through it. And we go through it perpetually. I have been through it myself, and so forth. So hard to give this up, to give that up, and so forth. No, but in order to live the good life, I must give that up. Well, I start off with a state of conflict. If I really see, but this is the good life, then I naturally let go of that which spoils the good life. If you discover that to stir in a lot of curry powder in your tea is not likely to make it very attractive, when you really see that as a fact, you no longer stir in curry powder into your tea. You don't have to have any conflict about it. It's just a simple thing. It's the same with the psyche. The soul just naturally withdraws from what it really sees is evil, is harmful, is destructive. It naturally withdraws. The thing is to see. See with your whole being, not merely with the eyes, not merely with the top layer of brain cells. That's not good enough. It starts there, of course. But it must just permeate the whole being. You really see, yes, no, this is... No, out with it. And you don't have any violence, any hate towards it either. You just leave it alone. So the living of the good life, the pure life, is actually a simple thing. If the simplicity is not there, if the ease is not there, then be sure that I or you have not seen the fact as the fact. Have not really seen what goodness is. This is very important. Now, we have talked a bit about really caring. But that really caring, the real pure urge from within, is free of anxiety. There is no anxiety about it. Oh, am I doing the right thing? This miserable conflict, am I doing the right thing? Oh, have I gone and done the wrong thing? Is an absurdity. Don't bother about it. You see, to use a slang phrase, don't care a brass button whether you did the right or whether you did the wrong. What's done is done. Know the fact that, yes, no, that was a mess. This was right. Just know the fact, you see, so that intelligence has really grown thereby. Know the fact. But don't have any conflict about it. Don't have any anxiety about it. Anxiety is there because it is always related to me, myself. One of the finest examples of the play of anxiety is an actor on the stage or a musician on the platform. The nervousness of the actor and the musician. We all, I know something about it from the musical point of view because I know what is the meaning of the phrase, oh, I lost 5 years of my life during the 5 minutes before I went on the concert platform. Yes, we know what that is. It is absolutely self-oriented. Am I going to... Oh, that's what it's all about. Why? Because I'm evaluating it. I'm caring for it. It's got to be such and such a performance and produce such and such a result, a good result. Good gracious me, if I'm going to be tied in this putty little sphere of just a concert hall, what's the use of my playing about with transcendence or infinity? You see? Just be at ease. Don't care. And when you know how rightly not to care, then you will really care. Because the first caring was self-oriented, self-concerned. It had the element of greed and lust in it, produce a result, a gain, make a show, etc., 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 present an image to the world. The world's completely mad. Everybody wants to present an image. Who wants the image? See? The first one was self-oriented. This other caring is the unself-caring. And that is love. That is the healing power. Through such caring, who knows, all sorts of extraordinary energies out of the one total reality flow through him as a focus. and spread healing, peace. The joy which has no, which does not depend upon an event or person, but the joy which is the pure joy of life itself, which is independent of that which is mortal, limited, temporary, passing. And this way there is strength. There is inner comfort. Strength from within, comfort. You see, what an extraordinary transformation takes place then, when that sort of caring is there. But its base must never be forgotten, the purity of life. What we mortals succeed unfortunately too well in doing is to stir in a little teaspoonful of deadly poison in the elixir of life. That's what we do. But the elixir of life is ours. Let this not be misinterpreted in terms, in shapes of the pleasurable, the pleasant, the successful. That which does not hurt us. Whatsoever our situation, this inner something cannot be touched. And because that inner something is the pure and the perfect thing, it will take all passing pleasure and pain in its stride. Which does not mean that it will not feel pain. I will certainly feel pain. And I'll feel pain, if I'm a perfected holy one, I shall feel pain far more than the unperfected, unwhole person. Far more. I will grieve far more. I shall be more sensitive. That is the point. I shall be infinitely more sensitive. But this inner mystery, this inner power, this inner poise, this strength, is the really invincible thing. Invincible without opposing anything. Invincible without fighting. It is victorious. This is the extraordinary thing. This is the fact. These are not just poetic sentiments or wishful thinking or anything of the sort. This is fact. So you see, the study of the essence of religion has no relationship to taking a book and studying it as we study algebra or chemistry or engineering or medicine or whatever it is, cookery, if you like. No relationship to that. The study of the essence of religion is to be completely observant of the process of life here and now, in the immediate present, constantly, and be so observant that there is no selfness which is throwing out its tentacles, grabbing at that which will give us benefit or pleasure or advancement or fulfillment or whatever it is. None whatever. This will die. Not only a case of this will die, but this is dying every moment. In our ignorance, we are unaware of the fact that birth-death is an instantaneous pulsation taking place constantly through every moment of time. Now what we mortals do is to try and delay the death process. Take, for example, an event. We carry over the memory of the pleasant part of it. We carry over the memory of the unpleasant part of it and all the rest of it. But this is just dragging a corpse from the past. A beautifully preserved mummy or a horribly decaying corpse. This is what we are doing. No, we don't want to do that at all. As we die from moment to moment, let the death be complete. And how is the death complete? Not by forgetting in the ordinary way, or as people ordinarily say, oh, don't let us think about this, this is too awful, or something like that. No, not that way. But by being so totally attentive to the immediate now, that the very next now receives that same total attention. And in receiving that same total attention, no residue of semi-attentiveness of the past is carried over as a debit account into the present. Then you really live. Then there is the zest of life. A zest which has no relationship with a petty little pleasure drive or our petty little conceptions of how life ought to be and so forth and so forth. These are the deep things which are absolutely essential. If transcendence is to be realized, start with transcendence. That's a curious thing to say. Then look at all the techniques and the procedures and the theologies and the systems which man has raised up. Then have a good look at them. And you will find they will all just disappear, you know, like clouds in the sky disappearing. Then there'll be the light that never was on land or sea. And the light which is completely associated is itself blissful, utterly blissful. The body may be in pain. You may get news. Your child has died, or your friend has been cruelly murdered, kidnapped or something. You will be sensitive to that fact in the ordinary emotional sense, of course, but there will be this which is transcendence working through it. The infinite and the transcendence does not refuse sorrow, pain, destruction, anything going wrong. It doesn't. It's all included in the infinite, is it not? If two galaxies suddenly collide and explode, just try and picture it. Two mighty galaxies colliding and exploding, and this is a fact, it happens. Does the infinite say, no, I don't like this, you shouldn't have done it? Not at all, it just contains it. I spit upon my Mother Earth. I don't actually, outside. Not because I'm afraid of the 2-pound fine, but I just don't, you see. I spit upon my Mother Earth, but my Mother Earth says nothing back in reply. Just takes it. It has the power of infinitely absorbing the whole of me. Good, evil, pleasant, unpleasant, stupid, wise, capable, incapable, whatever it is, it just absorbs me. It is that extraordinary absorptiveness, that infinite absorptiveness that emerges out of the inner being. And when that is there, then you are in upekkha, as the Buddha said. Upekkha, which has been so little understood. This extraordinary state of imperturbability coupled with this infinite sensitivity. And now you will perhaps understand why the Buddha places that as the fourth, the crowning stage of the whole complex, which comes under the single English word love. Metta, loving kindness; karuna, compassion; mudita, sympathetic joy in the happiness of others; and upekkha. It's a great mystery to most people why and how upekkha can be the crowning part of love, but it is. Because in this imperturbable state, this state of inner poise, there is this extraordinary all-absorptiveness. And as theistic religions put it, for instance, the divine love embraces everything. For God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son. And what does that mean? And sent his Son as a ransom for the many to be sacrificed. You see the significance of it? In our own personal lives. It is for us to live. So, let there be freedom from all illusions as regards the religious life. Oh, in order to be the true Holy One, you must go into a cave. And the icier it is and higher up in the Himalayas, the better it is. And meditate there for 25 years upon this, that, and that. All right, try the experiment. Enjoy yourself there, if you like and if you can. But don't get deluded that, this is the goods. Yes, George.
You said that sainthood is not transcendence. I always thought it was.
Sainthood is there, is manifest in the life of certain people who are harmless, who are truthful, who are possessed of the various virtues, and so forth. You see, there have been thousands and thousands of saints in the world, but that doesn't mean that all of them realized that through them, through all of them, transcendence was manifest or realized. There are many other things involved, George. You see, you take the great... Now, you know the Buddha, the life of the Buddha and the nature of the Buddha very well with years of study and observation and so forth. Not only was his life a saintly life, but look at all the other things. The wisdom, the understanding, the extraordinary skill and capacity, the different powers that he possessed. And so forth. You see? All this comes in. You know, speaking of himself, and time and again he used to speak of himself to the bhikkhus, to the disciples, he would say that if someone were to say of me, a being not liable to delusion has arisen in the world, then he would be speaking rightly about me. This is what he says several times. A being not liable to delusion. Now, think of that. You look at the lives of many a saint, And you will find that they certainly were liable to this, that, or the other delusion. They had certain beliefs, certain conceptions, certain narrow views. But they were saints. You see, goodness, intelligence, power, they all come into play. When you get the perfection of love and wisdom in harmony applied in the world, you get the perfection of power. We have considered this particularly earlier this year, you remember, two or three meetings we have considered this, or more in fact, that power is inevitably and invariably misused and brings about pain and destruction unless and until there is the basis of love and wisdom in harmony. Isn't that so? Now, have you any special questions? Or non-special questions? Yes, Sophia?
Starting with something.
Yes, I thought that would put the cat among the pigeons. In order to realize transcendence, start with transcendence. I use this phrase, the one total reality. But the one total reality is transcendence itself, isn't it? If I'm in harmony with the one total reality, in my inward understanding, you see, then transcendence manifests through this person, which has a name and a place of residence and all the rest of it. So if one reaches out to that transcendence, one is completely attentive, not self-oriented in that attentiveness, then you have started with transcendence. You see, that is the start. But what happens spasmodically at first, later on becomes the natural and the perpetual state. One may experience this. Now, you find it in the lives of all the mystics and the saints and so forth, and not merely the mystics and the saints, ordinary people like you and I in the world, ordinary people. We sometime or other have some sort of experience which was just indescribably divine. It may merely have been falling in love. Merely, but it's a tremendous thing. Or it may have been suddenly stepping out of the door at night and seeing a starlit sky. Or it may be just seeing a child in its pram suddenly look up at you and smile. And you know, the whole of transcendence is suddenly embodied in it, and your being just opens out into the newness which was never there before. A newness which had no preparation beforehand, which was not a consequence of a process. This is creation. This is the divine creativeness at work. And suddenly you awake in your awareness. Ah, This is something like it. But then, a few moments later, it is gone. Is it not? That wonderful light suddenly has dimmed down and vanished. Like a supernova which suddenly bursts out in the heavens, and then afterwards it has become unbright again, so to say. You see, it's like that. But you become the permanent supernova, so to say, if this urge from within is there. To give your entire being to transcendence, to God, use whatever word you like, to truth, to give yourself unaggressively, this is important. You must not demand that you be taken. You mustn't just stand on the doorstep till the door is opened and you're told, oh, come in for goodness sake, don't keep fiddling outside there in the cold. You don't stand on the doorstep. You almost sort of hide away from the infinite beloved. And then you're right there in the heart of the beloved. This is the mystery. No grasping whatsoever. How often the Buddha said. For instance, in one of the discourses when he's talking to Ananda, he says, Ananda, nirvana is the freedom of attention, of mind, from all grasping. The freedom from all grasping. And it is only the unselfed person who has ceased to grasp at all. Because then you see, when there is no grasping, finitude has vanished, and the infinite is there, manifesting itself through your finite being. This is the great mystery, the great marvel.
The phrase that comes to mind is, the light of common sense goes out and in the flat reveals the invisible world.
True.
I think the difficulty for those uninitiated, perhaps, in these ways of thought, is the habit of common sense prevailing. And no matter how often one repeats one's inner realization in words, it still remains, in a sense, meaningless for those outside. But it's pregnant with meaning for those who already realize. But the difficulty is in finding a phrase, perhaps just a single phrase, which will just allow the uninitiated to drop into the meaningfulness of the world. Mm.
Yes, that is true. This is what the Buddha called skill with means. What means are you going to employ with this person, that person, that person, that person? Skill in means, skill with means. Yes.
Do you feel that the juxtaposition of contradictions, as say in koans, has any place in this realization?
That is a way which appeals to a certain type of person and is useful for that person. You see?
Certainly I think one wants to get away from the literalness. What's become an obstacle?
The literalness.
Yes.
Yes, from literalness, yes. Yes.
But you mentioned the word masochistic earlier on. Mm. You could apply that in some way to a person who studies Zen and takes up the coins of the training. Because quite a number of them have mental breakdowns under the training, even Japanese.
There is always danger attached to effort. Not merely along these lines, but along any other lines. In the world of affairs, there is danger attached to so many things. I mean, look at working in a factory, for instance, these mighty big whirling machines, and if you unfortunately put your finger or your hand or head in the way, well, goodbye. That's the end. There is danger involved, of course. And the light goes out permanently if you look for it in the wrong way. The thing is not to look for it. It is there. Just be simple and sensible in the profound sense, sensible. Good sense, which is different from the ordinary common sense of the world. There is a very fine phrase you use, when the light of common sense goes out, which isn't a light. It raises up illusory shapes, common sense does, where the spiritual life is concerned. Because common sense has its roots in our animal being. It's all the animal urges and drives. I'm not saying anything against the animal urges and drives. They are part of the natural process, right. But they are all self-oriented. I am not an animal. I am a man. And a man is part animal. The soil, so to say, out of which the tree of man grows, is animal. The soil is animal. But the tree is different. You see? And what sustains the soil is different from what sustains the tree. These are things we have to realize for ourselves. Now, next time, we'll come back to actual meditation practice and certain aspects of it, if you like. But these preliminaries are so essential. It's funny to use the word preliminaries, because the preliminary is the whole thing, the goal itself, if one may use the word goal. The preliminary is the transcendent. Like the first step is transcendent. And it is the perpetual thing. It is, all this is an effort, is an attempt to try and help you to sort of let the sense of transcendence light up inside. See, when that sense of transcendence lights up inside, that is what in mystical terms has been presented as the Son of God. This is the Son. The supernal Trinity. Now, this comes out in the mysticism of the Zohar in one of its grandest forms. The Divine Trinity is the infinite, incomprehensible deity possessed of wisdom and intelligence. I point to different parts of my body because they figuratively represent it that way, in the shape of a man, sometimes in the shape of a tree, in the shape of a man. That's the Divine Trinity. The mercy and loving kindness and the power which manifests as the power of judgment and punishment, and mediating between the two, Tiferet, as it is called, or Rahamim, is compassion or beauty. And this imperfection is the center of man. You remember I've used that phrase before. Man is transcendence thinking. The whole of man is the thought of God. But thought not in our sense of the word. For us, a thought is simply a string of words. Every one of them has its root in that which is finite and particular and mortal. But this thinking is creative power, nothing else. And that's Tiferet. And that is the Redeemer. When the sense of transcendence has really burst out in us, the Savior, the Redeemer, is perpetually active. The Son of God, so to say, comes into his own kingdom. And once that has happened, for the rest of your life, it is there with you. It will not go out. If it has happened properly, it's easy to get misled about this to have this messianic complex and all sorts of similar things. And so you get the person who sets himself up as, oh, I am the one destined to redeem the world and I'm going to found the new church or the new religion and all the rest of it. He's a humbug. However sincere he may be in his beliefs, but he's just a megalomaniac. The Son of God, the Redeemer, is the quiet one, the silent one, the one who stays invisible, will not show himself publicly or proclaim himself publicly. He's the quiet one. If anyone comes to him, through him will be poured out spiritual sustenance, the bread and wine of life, of real life. You see? And that is Tifereth, or as it is to use the other word, Rahamim. Rahamim is compassion, Tifereth is beauty. It's very interesting that the two different words are used. And that is the mediator between loving kindness, mercy, which can go to the extreme and the structure of the universe would break up if there was no proper cohesion. There must be a power which balances and keeps order. You see? This is the idea of karma, the Indian idea of karma, in terms of Jewish mysticism. Then there is the strength and the majesty of God. There is the creative power and the glory, the kingdom, the Shekinah, as it is called. See, Judeo-Christian mysticism is a marvelous thing. It's actually Judaic mysticism from which all the life springs of Christian teaching emerge, but Christendom more or less just leaves it alone, says that, oh, this is Judaic, this is not Christian, but it is Christian essentially. It only happens to come later on in time, when the great Christian mystics put forth their own forms. They were apparently different, but if you look carefully at them all, you will see the relationships. And the astonishing thing is that the Semitic traditions and the deep Semitic esoteric teachings, and by Semitic I mean the three great religions which emerged in Western Asia, you see, are the same as those which arose in India. This is quite extraordinary, because the two race groups are quite different, the Semitic group and the Indo-Aryan group. Nevertheless, it was the one truth that they presented in their own different forms. Well,
which is the third Semitic race, the Arabs, the Jews, and the Persians?
Muslims.
Oh, I see.
The mysticism of Islam, the Sufis and so forth, is also extraordinarily alike. Yes, George?
What do Sufis Islam?
Oh, no, no, no. Sufism has its foundations in Islam. It was after Muhammad.